Happy New Year. We're starting 2025 with a preview of the episodes to come this year. We'll be featuring interviews with Steve and thought leaders and security experts from around the world, and we're looking forward to bringing you those conversations. We'll start with Rear Admiral Brian Luther. After more than 30 years in the U.S. Navy and at the Pentagon, Brian is now president and CEO of the insurance firm Navy Mutual. In this clip, he tells Steve what he learned about leadership in his time commanding an aircraft carrier in the Navy.
You know, I have a couple of adages I found that the more senior you got, I learned that you start with three phases of leadership, right? First is I did it. Then you become a leader of a team, and then it's we did it. And then you become a leader of leaders, and then you have to delegate. And so it's they did it, right? And so when you're in the I did it stage, you're learning, you're getting your game up, the technical specs. This is where you establish your professional competence, right? And then being a leader of a team, the first thing, you know, I would say I lead with trust, but in order to lead with trust, you have to train, right? So if you're going to empower people to do something, you have to train them so that they know very clearly what the expectations are and they have the capability to do it. Because if you want to empower and push down, but your training doesn't rise to that level, there's going to be a gap, right? And nobody wants to fail in whatever they do. So they want to be properly trained. And then if they do well, they want to be recognized. I would say the leader shines brightest with reflected light. So you're setting these people up for success. And then when you're in that final stage and you're delegating, you have to very clearly, we call it commander's intent. You have to very clearly articulate to the people, you know, what you want done. And if it's very specific, you say, I want this done. And if it's generic, you say, I want this outcome, right? You can't say, I want a general outcome when you have something specific in mind, because they're going to go off and do it whatever way you want. But if you're very clear, I want this done this way, or I just want this outcome, and you let them, you know, you decide, you delegate, disappear, you'd be amazed at what people can do. And like, for example, on an aircraft carrier, I couldn't be, there's 3,000 spaces in an aircraft carrier. You can't be everywhere, right? So you have to train them, you have to trust them. And then once they see the success, it becomes a virtuous cycle and people want to keep winning. And that's just how I did it. A thousand ways to skin the cat.
Next, we hear from Duncan Wardle, the former head of innovation and creativity at Disney, who speaks with Steve about how leaders can embrace creativity and inspire innovation in their teams.
If I were to ask people listening today, I said, what's the biggest barrier to being more innovative and creative where you work? Bang. Over 60% would say, I don't have time to think. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think AI is about to give us? It's going to do our weekly reports for us. It's going to do our compliance training for us. It's going to do our expense reports for us. It's going to do all the mundane stuff that will give us time to think more creatively. And look, we were all born creative. When you were a little boy and you were given a gift for a holiday and it came in a huge box, it took you ages to time to take the toy out of the box, because the box was the same size as you were. Mm-hmm. What did you spend the rest of the week playing with?
The box.
Yeah. It was your fort. It was your castle.
Absolutely.
We were all born creative.
Yeah.
Small children, what's the number one question they ask you again and again and again and again and again and again? One word.
Why?
Why? Why, why? Because they know you lied the first time. That's why. They are after the core consumer truth. They're after the insight for innovation. Our data is good today, but it's not as good as a six-year-old. Our data goes to the second why. The insight for innovation comes on the sixth why.
Dr. Kate Darling is up next. She's a research scientist at the MIT Media Lab and research lead at the Boston Dynamics AI Institute. And she told Steve about her findings after years of studying human-robot interaction.
So if we're putting robots into things like, I don't know, medical environments, care home environments, you know, these sorts of things, how do we, or do we need to, develop a degree of trust, do you think? Do we need to train people to use the robots or train the robots to work with the people? Where do we sit on all of that?
I mean, we need all of that, right? And there's also, there's a lot of mistrust and also misconceptions around the technology just based on all of the science fiction and pop culture that we have in Western society, where we're sometimes overestimating or underestimating what robots are capable of. I do think one very interesting thing about trust when it comes to those robots that we in particular humanize or project life onto, it's both easy to generate trust if you have like a very cute robot that's responding in a way that you expect a living thing to, but it's also very easy to break that trust. And I right. think it's because we're anthropomorphizing these systems, you don't expect your iPad to be deceptive. But if your iPad, looked like a little person and was like making certain mistakes, you might suddenly become mistrustful of it in a way that you wouldn't necessarily of just the iPad, because we have this social projection onto anthropomorphic machines. And so that's something that actually Brian Scassolotti at Yale has done a lot of work around, how we trust anthropomorphic technology, but also that trust can be broken very easily.
Next, we hear Steve's conversation with best-selling author and hypnotist Paul McKenna about something that affects all of us, stress at work.
First of all, how can people, it sounds maybe a little bit silly, but how can you identify that you're under stress? What are some of the things that people can look out for?
Right, so if you get bad moods, if you get sick, if you find that you can't sort of concentrate, your mind's racing too much, you know, those sorts of things. And very often, as you rightly say, it's very hard to detect if there's something up with you until you've reached a point where there's a very big signal, i.e. you get sick or burn out. And so the signals on the way to that, as I say, are things like mood swings and racing mind and, you know, these sort of things. But also when your friends or colleagues tell you, they say, you know, you're right, that sort of thing. So I'm very much a health maintenance guy, you know, rather than waiting till it's too late. So, you know, I do things for self-care, like acupuncture. I sometimes do a bit of yoga. I certainly listen to my own hypnotic trances because I have a busy mind and I like to get calm, that sort of thing. But, you know, also a good walk in nature. A 15-minute walk in nature is proven to be a brilliant way to reduce stress, because you have all the positive overwhelm from the beauty of nature around you. You know, so those sorts of things are, they're kind of simple things that make a big difference. And, you know, one of the things I like to do when I'm having a walk in the park in the morning is I do a gratitude list in my head. I think about all the things, my health, you know, all the people I love, my job, where I live in the world, you know, things like that. And then I think about small things like that first cup of tea in the morning is fantastic, you know. And so that sort of sets me up for a good day. So I find that if I get my head in a good space at the beginning of the day, the rest of the day sort of follows.
This next clip is from Steve's conversation with author and leadership expert Sylvie DiGiusto.
Authenticity is key. And authenticity, as most people understand it, is a lie.
Tell me more about that.
Because many people understand authenticity means I can just do whatever I want. You just do you. Right?
Right.
And that is a lie. I think that authenticity means that we all play a role. Mm-hmm. Still, but different roles. And in those roles, we are true to ourselves. But to be honest to you, if I'm at home, I play a specific role as a mother. Mm-hmm. And I'm very true to myself as a mother.
Right.
But I play a different role as a wife. Mm-hmm. And I play a different role as a speaker on stage. And I play a different role as a business owner, mm-hmm. a tough business owner when I have to negotiate contracts. And I play a different role as a volunteer. Mm-hmm. And in all those roles, I promise you, I'm truly authentic. But if I would try to talk with my husband the way I talk with my clients, we wouldn't made it through 23 years, I promise you. Or if I would treat my clients like I treat my children, or right. if I, you know, look at home like I would on stage and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we are all authentic in those roles, but I think we have to accept that you just do you, no matter the circumstances, which brings us back to situational awareness, mm-hmm. I think is a lie that this is possible.
Next, we'll hear a clip from Steve's conversation with Paul Bartel, a senior intelligence analyst with Peak Metrics, who previously worked at the Defense Intelligence Agency. He and Steve speak about how companies and nations can fight back against misinformation.
Part of the problem, I think, with social media is that you can't really go on and say whatever you want. So the biggest thing I think that needs to start happening is the social media companies really especially need to take accountability for their own clientele base that might be spreading the misinformation. Mm-hmm. we have, you know, mechanisms and tools in place now where we can identify the accounts that are actually spreading the misinformation. But that's where we need to be able to give that information to the social media corporation and say, here is this list of 1,200 accounts that we've identified that are pushing terrorist propaganda on your platform. You need to deplatform those accounts. Mm-hmm. In addition, another thing that I think that needs to happen is the counter messaging that we're having. When we see them come out with a message, what is it that we can say that actively counteracts that? So if we have a narrative of some sort that's saying the Gaza humanitarian pier is being built with rubble and bodies, and that's how the U.S. is building this thing. Well, first of all, say no, it's not. And then also provide evidence of how that's actually being constructed, because what you can see is it's very clearly a very modern structure that's not being built with rubble.
We'll be bringing you these full conversations on the ISF podcast in 2025.